Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another episode. We've got people coming to us from all over the place and in all sorts of different ways on this week's episode. This is how we do things here when we try to bring together our diverse resources. And of course, one of those individuals is my esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley, coming to us from her car as she is coming home from work and wanted to make sure she was in on the recording of this segment. So, Sam, you're pulled over, you're in a safe spot, and you're ready to join us for the show.
Yes, we call this Murphy's Law. Just couldn't get away from work soon enough and got caught in traffic, but that just shows you the flexibility of podcasting. We can do it from pretty much anywhere.
Oh, so, definitely. Hello, all. Definitely. And we also are joining us from Paragon Medical Education Group, our good friend Joe Holly. Dr. Joe Holly, how are you doing today?
Hey, guys. Good to talk to you again.
It's good to have you on. And you are the one that kind of put us in touch with our fourth member of the panel today. Dan, is it Dan Hanfling? Is that correct? Did I pronounce your name correctly, Dan?
Yeah, yes, you did, Jamie. You got it right.
That's good. It's great to have you on the show. Joe put us in touch with you. We met you briefly down at the Preparedness Summit, but weren't able to connect to actually record with you there. But I think that it's a better opportunity to have you on the same call with Joe. So I'm glad to have you.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and it's always good to be connected with Joe Holly, even if it's over the internet, over the airwaves. Glad to be with you, Joe.
Well, thanks, Dan. We're really glad to have you here. We really appreciate you contributing to the Disaster Podcast. You have tremendous amounts of experience and some really unique perspectives on some very unique aspects of disaster medicine. So we're really glad to have you with us today.
Thanks.
Dan, before we get into the rest of the show, just real quickly, could you give us a brief introduction, background, what your expertise is and where you fit into disaster response?
Yeah, I'm a practicing emergency physician. I practice in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in Fairfax, Nova Fairfax Hospital. And Nova was the unlucky site of recipients of the 9/11 attacks. It also happened to have been one of the few places outside of the continent of Africa where Ebola virus was treated back in the late 80s, made famous by a book written by Richard Preston called The Hot Zone. And, of course, we were the site where two of the inhalation anthrax cases were successfully diagnosed and treated by our staff, by my colleagues in our emergency department. So sort of seem like the crosshairs are squarely on our back. And in the context of all of that sort of big picture disaster, history, I have spent the last 15 years, amongst other responsibilities, as one of the medical team managers for Virginia Task Force 1, which is a part of FEMA's Urban Search and Rescue System and also one of two internationally sanctioned teams to travel abroad for requests to large-scale disaster events. So I've had my hands full. I've had some experiences, and I hope to share some of them with you and your listeners today.
Fantastic. Well, and we're going to actually, our main topic later on in this episode is going to be talking about the international aspects of deploying from a disaster team. And you're a perfect person to bring in and talk about that topic. So we're looking forward to that. Before we get to that, though, I'd like to ask all of you to kind of chime in. We've got some news, disasters in the news that have been going on over the recent days and recent couple of weeks. And some of the things we're following up on items we've discussed before, but also some new tragic events that have overwhelmed the system in somewhere in the world, and we'll talk about that coming up here. But first off, let's talk a little bit about what's going on the mudslide, the ongoing events out in Washington State. Joe, you brought this up. You said that federal assets are demobilizing there after being deployed for a period of time.
Yeah, that's correct. The federal USAR system has been active out there. They've had an incident support team in place there for, gosh, probably 3 weeks. I know we're actually on our second rotation of people out there. And then I think California 7 and was active out there. And then multiple dog teams have been active out there. So I just saw in the last call I had with FEMA that those assets are finally being demobilized. And I just heard on through some news sources that there's only a couple of people still missing. So I think it's beginning to wind down finally, but that's clearly been a tremendously long deployment for search and rescue resources.
Yeah, this is Dan. You know, I know that a couple of our, I think three of our dog handlers from Virginia Task Force 1 were mobilized with their cadaver search dogs about 2 weeks ago. So this really was a full court press, an all hands on deck effort until, as Joe said, until just recently for what was a very tragic event.
How does that work, Joe, when someone has to demobilize? Is this something that a federal order comes down and says, all right, we've given enough resources, it's time to do that? Or is that something they work actively with state resources on hand to say, how much longer do you need us?
Well, I think it's probably more the latter. You know, in general, as they plan ahead for the days to come, an assessment is made on what resources are going to be necessary to do that. And at some point when the local and or state resources feel like they are beginning to get things under control, they'll let the federal level folks know that, you know, they're ready to start winding down. And that puts the wheels in motion to get a demobilization order that comes actually out of FEMA HQ in D.C., you know, tells people when their time is done and they're free to head home.
Now, speaking of extended deployments, the search for the wreckage of the Malaysian airliner that went down presumably in the southern Indian Ocean. We still don't have any confirmation of that. No wreckage has been found, no floating debris. In fact, they've at least for the time being, I saw in the news today that the air search is called off primarily for weather, but they're really considering that the air search for surface debris is about over. But that looks like that could go on for months or even years before they find that. And it's a big mystery.
Well, I think Joe put it well before the podcast. It's the Amelia Earhart of the current generation. It could be years before if they ever figure this out.
It really is a mystery, you know, and especially given all of the technology that we have to presume is out there. I mean, we're all listening to each other. Isn't that what Edward Snowden sort of made clear? That with all that listening, with all that careful watching and, you know, consideration with regards to who moves what assets where, it is mystifying that nobody could figure out where that aircraft is.
Well, I think it's part of it is that it's in one of the more remote parts of the world. It's a part of the world no one was really looking at, it seems to me, when I hear people talking about satellite assets and surveillance and things like that. There's just nothing there to surveil normally.
Right.
And I feel for the families. It's one thing to have a person, a body, remains to bring home, but we have no idea where in the world they are. That's even hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really heart-wrenching.
Yeah, and speaking of heart-wrenching, the capsized and sinking of the ferry in South Korea really has been pulling at me as a parent of teenagers and kids who are, you know, go on school trips and go to events all the time. It you know, I'm constantly worried, and to see the families that are dealing with the tragedy of losing their children and in such numbers there. But I think about it as a responder, looking at the need for specialized resources. I mean, there are only so many you know, salvage divers in any given area to bring in to do some kind of the specialized diving that they're doing there.
Yeah, you know, yeah,
I think you're exactly right, Jamie.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, you know, what I was going to say is there's no question, you know, that those, you know, those specialized needs are there. But what's even more mystifying as a responder, and all of us on this conversation, you know, have, you know, cut our teeth in doing this sort of work. It's just incomprehensible that the ship turned, it capsized, but it didn't sink right away. And it seems like there were minutes, if not hours, available to potentially save what could have been hundreds of lives, and yet the crew chose not to do it. That's what seems to be coming out in the news. And it just seems like, you know, just it's impossible to understand how a tragedy of this magnitude could be allowed to unfold, given the fact that there was what seems to be time to be able to potentially save people. And I'll tell you, I mean, there's a picture on the front page of the paper the day after it happened, and the ferry is capsized, but it is above water. And it seems like that was the opportunity to make a difference.
That makes no sense.
Well, I think it speaks to, you know, we talk about being prepared, and we just came back from a preparedness summit, and certainly that preparedness message, I think, speaks to everyone, both responders and passengers in an event like that, that you need to make note of exits, and you need to make note of resources like life jackets and lifeboats. But the crew itself needs to be able to make that decision to put people in the water. And it sounds, based upon the interviews with crew members and even statements from the captain that have been made publicly, that they really were afraid to put people into the cold water prematurely. They really didn't expect the boat to go over as fast as it went over. And they just weren't willing to pull the trigger and say, everybody in the water. And I think that's something that, you know, we're going to look back in hindsight and say that was a bad call. But I wonder if there were preparedness drills or something that we could have done, that could have been done previous to this, and maybe will be done moving forward, to make sure that people are aware that the crews are trained properly, and that they have the knowledge that resources can get people out of the water. They can't get them out of a sinking boat.
Really good point, Jamie. I hope you're right. I hope that there's always some good that comes out of every disaster, and if it's just something we learn how to do it better next time, then it's not to say it would be worth it, but at least something good comes out of it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a message that will resonate with, you know, the listeners of this show is that as responders, we have to anticipate the worst, and oftentimes we do. I mean, we think about, you know, a house fire as, you know, resulting in much more structural damage than we might see, or we think about, you know, going into a collapsed building with much more instability than there may be, because we have to account for the worst. And I think that in this case, as you said, there was a sense that, no, it's not going to get any worse than it already is. And there was no anticipation of things getting, you know, getting more severe. And I think in that lies the lesson, you know, to remember as part of preparedness that you have to anticipate how things are potentially going to go, even if they don't go that way. That's what we get paid to do. I mean, they call us, you know, pessimists or, bring on the black cloud. But ultimately, that's how we have to play these sorts of events in order to save lives and save people.
Plan for the worst, hope for the best.
I think you're right, Dan, in a lot of ways. I also wonder sort of how much what the influence of significant cultural norms are in situations like this. And, you know, certainly you having had some international deployments in the past and worked with teams from every part of the world, you know, I know there are a lot of interesting cultural differences in how these kind of things are approached.
Yeah, and there's no question, you know, in some of the Asian cultures, there is, you know, a sense of deference and respect, certainly respect for the elders, and there's no question that some of those cultural tendencies overlay decisions that are taken, information that's exchanged, and in the context of large-scale, you know, complex disaster events where you have Americans who come in and do things quite differently than is seen in many other cultures, whether that's, you know, European cultures or Asian cultures. Sometimes those differences can result in misunderstanding or miscommunication. So sensitivity to those cultural differences is indeed an important part of dealing with the diplomacy of international response.
And this Dan, tell us where you might have been. What are some of the deployments that stick out in your mind that might be relative to that thought, being in a totally different culture?
Well, you know, the first large-scale international deployment that I did as part of the urban search and rescue system was to the Izmit, Turkey earthquake in the summer of 1999. This was a 7.1 or 7.2 Richter scale earthquake on the eastern Sea of Marmara, maybe 150 miles east of Istanbul, and resulted in, I think to this day, something like, I think the estimates were 35,000 to 40,000 deaths. I mean, it was a widespread, very shallow, very devastating quake. And it was very interesting because, you know, in Turkey, where the population is predominantly Muslim, you know, there's a great sense of recognition that if someone has died, that you have to bury the remains, you know, you retrieve the remains, you bury them, preferably within the same day. And so, you know, of course, there was tremendous hope for the potential to rescue live victims. And actually, over the span of our almost two-week deployment there, we were able to make four live rescues, which were actually, I believe, the first live rescues that were registered in the American USAR system. But there were so many more who were dead and whose families wanted us to retrieve bodies and in fact help them prepare them for burial, which of course is way beyond our mission space, and really was in the context of our primary mission, which is to save lives, was going to take us away from doing just that, and that was, you know, one of many cultural touchstones that, you know, we had to be very sensitive about, because we wanted to be clear that we respected and understood the deep need to provide that level of closure, but that our mission was not to do that, that we were still looking to try to save people who would be alive. And, you know, that's a hard message when you're faced with somebody who before them can see but can't quite retrieve, you know, members of his or her family that are buried in the rubble.
Wow, that's a rough one.
You know, that.
One of the reasons go ahead, Dan.
Well, and I was going to say that you know, with the international deployments, you know, one of the things that that the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, which is essentially the lead coordinating agency for U.S. disaster response abroad, under the auspices of USAID, actually provides some cultural sensitivity training. We actually will get a briefing, a team briefing from, you know, one of the cultural attachés in the case of the Turkey deployment, but a number of our other international deployments, will actually have native speakers. So we had a translator who was Turkish who came with us from the United States and who can provide a little bit of that insight and cultural grounding as we begin to see the events unfold, you know, over the course of the deployment.
You know, what I was going to say was I can relate to that one because in 2000, the state of California, with a number of disaster people, with the Air National Guard, went over to Ukraine to do a training mission. And one of the things they showed us was this huge inflatable hospital that they have that they mentioned they had used in Turkey. And unlike us, where we would triage people then send them off on a C-130 somewhere, they say, we have no place to take people. They live and they die right here. And this is a fully functional hospital. So as much as that area of the world doesn't have the assets and the fancy tools we have, they are so productive, and their ability to do the best with what they do have was just astounding to me.
Yeah, and that is, you know, that is oftentimes, I think, one of the humbling aspects of having the opportunity to represent, you know, the government of the United States in the context of these disaster response situations, and that is to recognize how much we do have, how much we oftentimes take for granted, and how folks, you know, across the globe manage with what they have. And and manage quite well oftentimes. In some cases, maybe even better than certainly would be expected, or better than we might think. And yet it is it's humbling to be able to recognize just the the fact that we are coming from abroad, we're coming to render assistance, we're helping people oftentimes at times of great need. And I think, another example from my disaster deployment experience was the response to the Haiti earthquake. Of course, everyone's familiar with the awful events that, befell Port-au-Prince. And, you know, again, coming back to just, you know, one of the cultural touchstones that I just remember so well, you know, here is a population that was suffering so greatly. So many, you know, thousands, tens of thousands who were dead, and a city that was absolutely in ruins, and people who, even before the earthquake, you know, were in many cases well below poverty level, what we would call poverty level, you know, living, you know, by subsistence means and so on. And here we would, you know, climb out of the Humvees or, you know, out of our transportation vehicles, and we'd have our MREs and we'd have our water that was, you know, bottled and clean. And, you know, we made a point never to eat in front of any sort of public gathering. We wouldn't even drink our water necessarily in front of public, if for no other reason than not to incite jealousy. Because these are people who were grappling to get by. Lord knows, you know, how many family members they themselves lost, let alone, you know, whether they had access to food or water. So these are the kinds of things that one encounters in the context of an international deployment.
Yeah, I didn't go, but my DMAT did, and the one thing that stuck out is how appreciative these people were that we came from that far away just to help them. And this is something you might see more internationally and nationally, unfortunately, but they really, really were appreciative of us being there. And Jamie, I am totally taking over this conversation because I'm so fascinated with what Dan has to say, but I'm sure you got a question in there.
I'm just enjoying listening to the two of you talk, and the reason you're my co-host, Sam, is you've got the deployment experience that I don't have, so I really often defer to you in these types of conversations. But Joe, do you have something you'd like to jump in with?
Yeah, Dan, I'd be interested in sort of hearing your take on the wide variety of capabilities that many of these teams bring to the table, and a little bit about the actual problems that can cause in many cases.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good question. The you know, for your listeners who may not be as familiar with the urban search and rescue system, I mean, the first thing, you know, to emphasize is that we're not all that different than our task force is not all that different than any of the other 27 task forces across the system. Ours and LA County are the two that have the contracts to be able to travel internationally. Although, as we saw during the Haiti earthquake, a number of our fellow FEMA teams were deployed as well, New York and Virginia Beach, and I can't even remember who else now. But the you know the, so from a just from an operational perspective, there's tremendous similarity now. We have a second cache that is completely different. It is the AFTA supplied cache that is sanctioned under the UN guidelines. The UN established what is called the International Search and Rescue Advisory Guidance, and or otherwise known as INSERAG. That is a UN-led international effort that has been meeting. It has regularly scheduled meetings. It had representatives from international teams in the search and rescue community across the world and established guidelines for what the response to an international event would look like. And, in fact, has really led the way with regards to organizing and professionalizing international disaster response. So as an example, under INSERAG guidelines, one of the things that's required is that teams who are going to deploy in an international setting have to undergo a classification process, what they call an IER, or an international classification, essentially. And this is essentially a test. In the case of Fairfax, we have successfully completed two of these IER classifications. We, I think, we're the first international team to undergo the process, and now I think we're also the first to have undergone it a second time. We deploy our 72-member team with the support elements, and although it was conducted here in Fairfax County, one of the local schools was turned into essentially a customs and immigration center, and for all we knew, we were in the middle of wherever we were, and presented with passports and shot records, and essentially were evaluated on a whole host of specific tasks to be able to meet this classification process. This has really, I think, moved the needle forward with regards to the professionalization of disaster response. In fact, I would say that it is much more advanced than the current method by which medical teams respond to similar events. The other sort of element to your question with regards to different teams is that although the teams that you know that respond should have some similarity because they are presumably a part of the international classification system, still in the end have their own you know their own flavors and their own approaches and you know their own concepts when it comes to delivery of care. So I'll give you an example of that. In 1998, when our task force responded to the Nairobi embassy bombing, the first of what was, you know, really the Al-Qaeda attacks, I guess, one of the first of the coordinated Al-Qaeda attacks, we were there on site with the Israeli Army's search and rescue team. And it was interesting. It was the first time that we noticed and heard or saw a different approach to dealing with collapsed structures. I was not there. I was back here in Fairfax County just really getting my feet wet in the urban search and rescue world. But the Israelis took an approach in which they would essentially delayer. They would pick something off the top and clear it and look, and then pick the next piece of rubble off the top and clear it and look. Whereas our team, really in experience honed all the way back to response to the 1985 Mexico City earthquake, really focused on tunneling, kind of making sure things were relatively stable, and tunneling and going down and under to try to see if there were void spaces to try to get people out. And this was a difference of operational approach between the Israelis and the American team. And, you know, those are just the sorts of things that you are likely to encounter in the context of these large, complex events where there are a lot of work sites, there's a lot of work to be done, and oftentimes teams find themselves, you know, having to share a work site or share the effort to try to save a life.
We saw a similar thing in Ukraine, just looking at it from the medical perspective, but it was a great learning experience. We were worried about seasparing. They were worried about infection, which isn't something we think about in a big disaster. But what you were saying earlier, Dan, about this assessment process, DMATS, as the medical team, are very new to international deployments. In fact, the first one, which surprised all of us, that we were even responded to, it was Haiti. And that's relatively recent, given all of the ones you've been discussing. So I'm kind of, what you're saying is kind of looking into our future in terms of the types of assessment, which may be necessary to really get us ready for an international deployment. Because right now, that there's not that much of a system there. We just go and we figure it out as we go. So I think what you guys are doing on the USAR side is something that's going to be valuable for all of the deploying federal teams at some point.
Yeah, and I, you know, Sam, I think that that's exactly right. And indeed, the WHO has convened a series of meetings now. I think the first one was in Cuba. Two Christmas times ago, and then there was a more recent meeting about a year ago. Which essentially is moving the ball towards a goal line of creating a registry process for medical teams so that the medical teams will have essentially a classification process or some means of knowing, you know, when you ask for a team, it's like resource typing. When you ask for a team, you know what you're going to get and you know what they're going to be able to do. And I think that, you know, again, in the context of international response, the professionalization of disaster response is long overdue. I think it is going to be of great benefit and will allow us really hopefully to be able to provide better care and with better outcomes. Haiti, again, is a case in point. There were probably many procedures that were done that maybe shouldn't have been done. There were certainly response teams that were there that had no business being there. And as we know, one of the first lessons of disaster response is don't turn yourself into a disaster victim. You're just going to create more work for those who are coming to do the rescue. And in some cases, unfortunately, that was evident in Haiti. So, like you said before, I mean, you know, these are all opportunities to learn and improve upon what we do. And I think that's the spirit by which we have to look at, these sorts of events so that we, you know, the next time out the door, we're doing something better than we did last time.
Exactly. I have a strange feeling that Jamie's sitting there trying to jump in and cut us off because we've gone a lot longer than we usually do. But I have to say, this is fascinating, Dan, and I think we just scratched the surface of discussions we could have with you. We didn't even let Joe in very much on this one. I would love to do this any number of times with you because I think there's plenty of fodder for discussion. We kind of went off on one area this time, but there's so many different things we could discuss about international deployment that I'd love to have you back again. Jamie, I'm going to toss it back to you.
Oh, well, thank you. And Dan, I second what Sam just said. I think we're already going to make people hungry to have you back on in a future episode, talk some more about this topic and other topics that will give us a sense of this international deployment, as well as some things you'd like to talk about regarding some of your domestic deployments and experiences as well. So we look forward to having you on in a future episode.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to, to chat with you guys today on this one, and I look forward to, picking up the ball where we left off and, sharing some more insights about this work down the road.
Well, we
and a lot of what we've been, a lot of what we've been talking about too is the importance of training people for these various difficult missions and very different cultures. And I got to throw this back to Joe because that's what Joe does with Paragon. And well, I want to give you the last word here, Joe.
So, well, I appreciate that, Sam. Thanks so much. It's fascinating. To me, just the work is challenging enough in a domestic world, but when you layer on top of that all sorts of language barriers and cultural differences and differences in equipment and approach and training and all of that stuff really makes for a very complex and challenging situation to deal with. And certainly the deployment of teams on an international event means that it's a very major event in the first place. I mean, it would be, it's like the New Madrid earthquake here in the U.S., and we've actually talked at some of our FEMA incident support training events about the integration of international teams for a response here in the U.S. and all the issues that may well arise from doing that.
Good point.
Well, and Joe, we do want to thank you and Paragon Medical Education Group for supporting the Disaster Podcast and making it possible for us to put this show together every week. And and every week I find some resource out there or some situation or we had that active stabbing incident that happened a week or so ago and in the school, and I thought of you guys instantly because you have that active shooter training that you bring to systems that help integrate the different services, the police, the fire, the EMS, the hospital system, all so that they can work, they can be trained to work closely together so that when an incident like that happens, they're prepared and ready to go. It certainly speaks to that, and I hope people will avail themselves of that. Where can folks find out more about Paragon?
Well, Paragon's on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, or you can find us on Facebook, Paragon Medical Education Group on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU.
Excellent. Well, I hope folks will take an opportunity to check out your website and your resources and maybe look at bringing your excellent training resources and what you call, and rightly so, an educational experience to their systems.
Well, thanks, Jamie. It is drawn from all the stuff that we talk about on this podcast. And, I think after talking to Dan tonight, perhaps we could even incorporate some sort of international flavor in there just to make it even more interesting.
Sounds good. Sam, where can folks find you?
I'm pretty much anywhere under Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and, of course, at the disasterpodcast.com website.
And you can find me just about everywhere under the handle PodMedic. And, of course, you can find all of my shows over at the ProMed Network at promednetwork.com. So check out all of those resources there. We're going to go ahead and close out this episode of the Disaster Podcast. And I want to thank everybody for joining us as we close out. I think I'll just speak for Sam and remind all of you that, as she says, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.